Welcome to the Winter Palace Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Cole, editor and publisher of Death Sept Magazine. Today I'm happy to welcome back to the show the Duke of New York, Al Goetz, to talk about his latest book in the Charting the Territory series. This one is 71-73, Gulf Coast Wrestling, which is Pensacola and the Florida Panhandle, Southern Alabama and parts of Mississippi, the area that would later become Southeastern Wrestling and Continental Wrestling under Ron Fuller and the Armstrongs. We're going to talk about the main players in the territory in this time period, which is run by the Fields brothers. That is Cowboy Bob Kelly and the King Bobby Shane and Don Fargo, a bunch of other people, including young Steve Kern and Kevin Sullivan, young Ron Bass, along with his partner Don Bass and Ma Bass, a bunch of other people, including the quote-unquote other Samoans, and a bunch of other people. We're going to talk about how Al does most of his research, whether it's online or in person, and how to balance between the two. And we're also going to talk about the problems of being a wrestling historian. We talked about that on the show with Bo James recently, so we're going to get Al's thoughts on those matters. We're also going to do some brief baseball talk because this is the first week of the season. Al has already been on the road to see his Braves play in Chicago and Milwaukee, and the day we record this, which is the day that is going up, which is April 5th, Al is currently sitting in Truist Field watching the Braves in their home opener. So we thank him for squeezing us in today on such a busy day. Al also talks about his being inducted into the Waterloo Wrestling Hall of Fame. He is getting their Historian Award this year, so that's very cool for a friend of the show. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the Winter Palace Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Cole, editor and publisher of Odessa Steps Magazine. I'm happy to welcome back to the show. We've had this string lately where we haven't had people on that, people that haven't been on for like 6-7 years. I know it's been shorter than that for our guest this time, but I'm happy to say that he has a new book, so I'm always happy to have him back when one of those comes out to discuss it, since it's an area that is of my interest, although not necessarily the time period that I usually am interested in. And so to talk about that and a bunch of other things, wrestling related and also some non-wrestling stuff too, I'm happy to welcome back to the show from Charting the Territories, it's the Duke of New York, Al Goetz.
Hey, Mark, how's it going? Thanks for having me on again. Yeah, I think it was about a year and a half, maybe closer to 2 years when I was on the Winter Palace podcast previously.
Yeah, I couldn't. I think you were on to talk about the first book, and I think maybe the other two times we didn't get to schedules to line up correctly. But so yeah, this one, the first two books were about Leroy McGurk's Oklahoma, Louisiana territory, and then there's one about Central States. This one is about, as people often say, one of the like sort of unknown slash hidden territories, and that's Gulf Coast. And we're talking about the area that you usually research, and that is the early 1970s. This one is 1971 to 1973. So give us a quick overview of where this territory takes place and some of the bare bones before we get started.
Sure. Well, Gulf Coast Championship Wrestling operated in, not surprisingly, the Gulf Coast of the United States, which is around the Gulf of Mexico. So the main cities were Mobile, Alabama, and Pensacola, Florida. Also Dothan, Alabama, Panama City, Florida, and several towns in the southeastern part of Mississippi, including Laurel, Hattiesburg, Pascagoula, and Gulfport.
Now, this is something that I've become fascinated with lately, and I know it comes up on a lot of sort of like the historical podcasts. What did Gulf Coast actually call itself?
They might have used the term Gulf Coast Championship Wrestling publicly, but by and large, like most wrestling territories in the 70s and 60s, the TV just might have been named, you know, All-Star Wrestling or Big Time Wrestling or even just Wrestling. I'm not quite sure. Of course, this is one of the territories we have very little footage of as far as TV shows or house shows. And realistically, that's what my focus is with turning the territories, is I do try and shine a light on those territories where we don't have tons and tons of footage like St. Louis or Florida or Crockett, and where we don't already have subject matter experts that have written books like Mark James with Memphis and the Gulas territory. So we're sort of focusing on territories where we don't know a whole lot about them, and that's why they've never really been documented before. But we have enough info with the resources available to us now that we can put together a good timeline and idea of what was going on in the territory through house show ads and, you know, newspaper listings and results.
It's funny that it seems like almost every show, every territory, at least maybe in this time period, maybe a little after, that you're either All-Star Wrestling or Big Time Wrestling or Championship Wrestling, that, you know, that they weren't necessarily like regional names. It's, you know, which is why, you know, like we've had some of these weird lawsuits where, you know, people sue for, like, have the rights to names and things like that. You know, it was like the longest thing about the WWF not being able to have some of their shows on the network or on 24/7 back before, because there were issues over things like All-Star Wrestling or Superstars of Wrestling. Like, they were, like, just very generic names. Like, it was, you know, it was just, like, the name on the marquee says wrestling, as the old joke goes, and they weren't, you know, because you weren't competing with anyone else, so I guess you don't necessarily need to have any sort of brand specificity.
Right, and also perhaps one of the other reasons was because they didn't want to regionalize things. They really, when you watch the TV from a lot of these territories in the early 70s, there's this vague awareness that the wrestlers are working every night in different towns within a confined geographical area, but they really don't go out and state that. So when you call it Georgia Championship Wrestling, yes, that's good, you know, for creating like a home team or a local business, but realistically, they want fans to think these are the best wrestlers in the world. These are the all-stars of wrestling. These are the champions. So they use that very generic name to not regionalize things, not shoehorn themselves into an area. And of course, because many of them operated in more than one state, as a matter of fact, in this book, you will find that Gulf Coast ran at least one house show in the state of Georgia. So when a company calls themselves Georgia Championship Wrestling, that might be a misnomer of sorts. They also, of course, Georgia Championship Wrestling at times crossed over into parts of eastern Alabama because their TV was available in some markets that bled into the state of Alabama.
And at this point, Gulf Coast is owned by the Fields?
Correct. Lee Fields and his various family members are probably doing things behind the scenes. His father is running the shows in Mississippi. But Lee Fields, along with his brothers, had come to Gulf Coast in the early 60s, become top stars in the territory. And Lee basically moved into the promotional end of things and greatly decreased his in-ring activity by the late 60s, although one of the big angles that happens in 1971 is him coming out of retirement to take on the hottest heel that the territory had probably seen in several years.
And the Fields are part of the Fuller Welch family too.
Yes, they are related by marriage to the Fuller Welch, and then who also are related to the Goldens by marriage. It is also generally believed that the Fields family, whose real last name is Hatfield, are blood relatives of the Hatfields of the famous Hatfield-McCoy feud several generations ago.
Right. So it's I don't know if this is known or not, but so when Lee Field set up this area, was that sort of with the blessing of Roy Welch?
Well, what happens is, and we actually have an introduction, a little profile about the territory in the book, but he bought it from Ed Welch, Buddy Fuller.
Okay.
He bought Lee bought it in 1959.
Yeah, again, the history of the wrestling in the South, you know, except, you know, pretty much always somehow is connected to Roy Welch or one of the other Welches. And, you know, it's, you don't even have to do 6 degrees of separation to get to a Welch, probably, you know, for 40 years of wrestling in the South, if not more than that.
Probably longer than that, but yeah, and so many of the territories, even if they weren't actively involved, they still owned a small piece of the territory, as we've seen over the years with Gulas and Georgia and Florida. The Welches are if not physically there, they probably still are getting a small percentage of everything that goes on.
And I think when looking through all the people that worked in this time period, is Jackie the only one, is the only Welsh that worked there during these years that we're talking about?
I believe Ron has a handful of matches, and I think actually one of them, one of his earlier ones, he's billed as, and I forget if it was Ron or Rob, but they were billed as Ronald Welch for their first appearance, but they were not full-timers in the territory. But yeah, Jackie Welch shows up. Off the top of my head, I mean, there's so many wrestlers that come in and out of the territory, it's hard to know for sure, but I don't think any of them were full-time in the early 70s.
I'm trying to think of like, is if this is where, like, when Ron, I think, had like really early matches in his career, like maybe when he was still at college in Miami, that they were in some like very far away place where he like worked under a hood. And I want to say, like, maybe was it maybe in like in a Gulf Coast town, like instead of being in Florida or in Georgia where like Buddy was based at the time?
It's entirely possible. One of the fun things about wrestling is there are so many random mass characters. Like, of course, we know, you know, Jody Hamilton and Tom Renesso as the assassins or the famous versions of the medics. But every now and then you see a Red Shadow or a mass demon or so on and so forth. And there's very little resources out there that we can prove who was under that mask. So it is entirely possible that Fuller wrestled under a mask in Gulf Coast at some point, but I don't know for sure that that's the case.
It definitely seems like when you look at Gulf Coast and then later Southeastern and then later Continental, that like this is one of those areas where it seemed like they loved having lots of masked guys, whether it was just because they were rotating in so many people and you could just put a guy under a hood, like you said, as an assassin or as a demon or a shadow or somebody, or it's just, you know, that's just the way that, you know, wrestling developed in that part of the country, because you certainly had like long standing mass wrestlers too. Like in Gulf Coast, you had Wrestling Pro and people like that. But it just seems like when I think of like a territory that loves having masked guys, like Memphis and like Southeastern/Gulf Coast/Continental, it seems like they love having them there.
And I think that can be traced back to something you mentioned earlier, and that is the fingerprints of the Welch family, because that's also something that happens in the early 70s in Florida, and even in the 60s. There are some really fascinating angles that we look back on in Florida in 1971. This is something I just covered recently on the podcast, where Johnny Walker was wrestling as the Grappler, but then he's in a feud with Dale Lewis, and Dale brings in another masked wrestler, bills him as the original Grappler, who then loses a match to Johnny Walker where the loser can no longer bill themselves as a Grappler of any sort. So then the original Grappler now calls himself the Mr. Wrestling, still wrestling under a mask. He eventually loses the mask, leaves town, and a couple of weeks later, Tim Woods comes in as Mr. Wrestling. So they're also, they do the loser leave town matches where the loser comes back under a hood. As a matter of fact, Ronnie Garvin and Ron Fuller had a big feud centered around that in some of the B towns in Florida, which were promoted by the Welch family. So I think the masked characters, as well as some of the wild and crazy stipulation matches, can all be traced back to the Welch family's fingerprints. And that's the style of wrestling they had always promoted, because that's what they knew and that's what worked for them.
And then Ron did something like that in Knoxville, I think, with Dick Steinborn.
Yep.
With, you know, he was under a hood as somebody, and he left, I think, to go back to Florida. And then, but they kept, they brought in a guy who was now a heel using the same gimmick. And then eventually Steinborn comes back as that character, as a babyface, and it's like, no, that wasn't me. That was, like, I don't remember if it was Dale Lewis or somebody like that. So, you know, who could, you know, wrestle the same style, so it would be conceivable that it is the same guy.
Right. I think, I'm not sure if this is a different angle or but Steinborn did something similar to that in Memphis.
Okay.
As well. But it's very possible he did it in two different places. That's the other thing about wrestling. If something works in one territory, well, you can just do it in another territory. How many times did somebody stomp Malenko's false teeth?
Well, yeah, that's the great thing, especially when doing research in like this, like in the territory era, especially like before all the TVs that we have now are places we've never really had much TV, is, you know, like there's a saying that I think Dusty said that, you know, like you can repeat an angle every 7 years because of the turnover of fans. But it's also the kind of thing where when guys move around, you know, that if an angle works in Florida, that whether you're the booker or you're just one of the participants, if it works in Florida and you go to Crockett, you can tell Ole, you know, hey, we did this thing in Florida, because, you know, nobody's seeing everybody else's TV at the time. So you're just going by word of mouth. It's like, hey, we popped houses in Florida doing blah, 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 blah. Why don't we try this here? And, you know, that's why, yeah. And then especially when you start seeing the thing where bookers wrote, you know, when you sort of get that level that, I guess when you're high enough on the food chain and you're a booker and you go from place to place, you know, you can repeat your own angles because you know whether they worked or not. So it's like if, you know, Bill Watts is booking in Georgia and then he takes it to Florida and then he takes it back to when he finally buys Mid-South, you know, it's, if it works, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, history repeats itself on all the other cliches.
Exactly. There are things that work. And every now and then you find something that worked like gangbusters in Florida. If they try it in, you know, Texas, it does not work. So there's just a matter of trial and error. But that was the great thing about the territories, is literally so much of the booking, because they're running multiple towns every single week, is throwing things at a wall and see what sticks. And if it doesn't stick, well, then you just end the feud and come up with a new angle, come up with a new hook to get fans coming back the following week. At some point, you'll figure out how to rein them in, and angles that work in some towns in the same territory might not work in other towns in the same territory. But again, because they have this TV airing in different markets, they have the flexibility to, you know, to take what works in some towns and keep it going. And in other towns, they can just try something else.
And plus, when you're running the same towns week after week, like, you're going to burn through ideas so quickly that, you know, you're going to be taking them from wherever you can get them. And especially in ones that bomb, it's like, okay, we got to change on the fly, because, again, it's weekly business that's bringing in the money. Like, you don't have the luxury of, like, letting something do a slow burn, probably.
Well, yeah, and you also, but and at the same point, if you do decide to have a big show, you just take whichever angle is clicking at that time and work it. You don't need to build things up for months. Although in this territory, it does seem that they were planning They had big plans for Bobby Shane in 1971, which I mentioned earlier would lead to Lee Fields coming out of retirement. But you can always bring in the world champ, bring in this era, Haystack, Calhoun, and of course, a couple years later, Andre. Bring in the women wrestlers, bring in the little persons. If you have a big show, there's always a way to stack that card up with talent. You just take the feuds that are clicking in all your towns and just sort of run like a greatest hits show.
Right. And you mentioned Bobby Shane. Is it fair to say that he's probably the biggest star of this territory in the era that's covered in the book?
It all depends on what you think of Don Fargo. To me, it's a toss-up between the two. But Shane, up until this point in time, so this is 1971, he actually has his first show in Gulf Coast in December of 1970, where he does a one-off in Dothan while I think Georgia was taking some time off for Christmas. But up until that point, he had debuted in 64. He had been a babyface everywhere he went. And according to Bo James, who had got this information from Cowboy Bob Kelly, they sent Shane to a small territory to try out this heel gimmick just in case it didn't work. As you mentioned earlier, because it's so low profile, it wouldn't make the magazines and they could just almost sort of forget it happened. But deep down inside, they probably knew it was going to work or they wouldn't have even set it up in the first place. But Shane as a heel just clearly got over like gangbusters here. And leads to a big angle with Lee Fields where Lee comes out of retirement. They have a couple of really big houses in Mobile. And then Shane got over so well that even after he left the territory in late summer, he still comes back for big shows in Mobile throughout the year. And even all the way up through his passing in early 1975, he still shows up regularly, maybe not regularly, but at least a couple of few times a year for the shows in Mobile because the fans, he left such a strong impression on the fans.
Now, is this him as the king or is that something that comes later?
As best I can tell for his match with Lee Fields, he came out wearing a crown and white gloves. I can't state to a fact that that was the first time he did it because it's a couple of months into his run. But my guess is, yes, that's when he first proclaimed himself as the king of wrestling was for that match with Lee Fields, that first match with Lee.
And, of course, eventually Bobby Shane would meet Jerry Lawler, I think in Florida, and then sort of, I don't know if to bequeath the gimmick is the right word or give him the idea to do a similar gimmick in Memphis. But
right, that's the story.
But, yeah, but being – Jerry Lawler being the king comes directly from meeting Bobby Shane.
That's the story that's been passed down for years. And one of the great things about these stories in wrestling, there's no way to prove or disprove them. And sometimes we just have to take it at face value. But of course, a lot of these gimmicks, how many Nature Boys were there in wrestling and how many times was there some sort of unofficial or sometimes even official passing of the guard of these nicknames and gimmicks from one generation to another. I don't think Shane was the first king of wrestling. As a matter of fact, a year or so earlier, Thunderbolt Patterson was doing the king gimmick in East Texas. So again, like we talked about earlier with bookers taking things to different territories or things that worked in one area, doing it again, there were quite a few kings of wrestling over the years. And who knows who the first was, and if there's an official lineage, and if Hacksaw gave it to Harley, who gave it to Haku, who knows?
It's like, not everything is sort of as clear cut as, you know, Ric Flair feuding with Buddy Rogers over being the Nature Boy, and like Flair, you know, eventually beating Rogers is sort of, you know, you can say that like Flair kind of, you know, officially took the mantle from Buddy Rogers. I mean, Buddy Rogers was obviously still Nature Boy Buddy Rogers, but like maybe then Flair, because he's in his prime, is now the Nature Boy, you know, and then eventually, you know, we would have maybe gotten it with Flair and Buddy, you know, had Buddy not been Buddy.
Yeah, but again, these are just, you know, they're just nicknames, they're gimmicks. No one, I would say no one owns them, although I guess nowadays wrestlers are apt to copyright all their nicknames and whatnot. And I guess after Supernova started stealing everybody's moves, perhaps wrestlers got a lot more concerned about their IP, their intellectual property. But, you know, these are, again, the wrestling business, it's all cyclical, and what works in the past might work again. So wrestlers have an understanding that, you know, at some point they'll pass the torch on. How many Cowboy Bobs are there in wrestling?
And that's another prominent name in this Gulf Coast area. And Bob Kelly is probably somebody that a lot of people don't know about or may not have even ever heard of.
Yeah, he grew up, I think it was outside of Nashville, Tennessee, grew up on a farm near Louisville. He was born in 1936 on a rural farm near Louisville. He served in the Marines. And then he took up wrestling in the late 50s, and he came to Gulf Coast in 1966 and liked it so much that he pretty much never left. He's one of those guys, like almost like a, you know, a Danny Hodge, that stayed in one place for most of his career. And because of that, it might affect his status and his standing in wrestling circles, especially Cowboy Bob working a small territory. He, I believe he ends up owning a piece of the territory. I think he also had a couple of other some business interests outside of wrestling. But he just liked the area so much that he stayed there and never left.
And as we would see in later years, especially when we get to like Southeastern and Continental, how many people came there, liked it being a short trip territory with, you know, at least okay payouts, and because of the weather and other sort of, you know, quality of life issues, never left.
Yeah, the weather's great, the quality of life is good, the loop, as they call it, was short. I was on the short side. You're never more than a few hours away from home, no matter where you're booked in the territory. So you know, you can, like they said, like the guys who worked for Eddie Graham's would say, you could go out, lay out on the beach for a few hours in the morning, then go to the gym, then pack your stuff up, get in the car, head to the town, wrestle your match, and be in your bed at a reasonable enough hour that you could do it all again the next day.
And I think we've heard stories over the years from people working in Continental or in Florida of, like, maybe not even having like a house, that they would just live out of their car and sleep on the beach, is something you could do in Pensacola, or, you know, maybe in Tampa. You certainly couldn't do, like, if you were working for Vern or something like that. You know, you're not going to be sleeping on the shores of Lake Michigan.
Yeah, I was just in Chicago earlier this week, and it was in the low 30s, and there was snow in early April. So I don't think that's a good idea for a wrestler.
One of the other people that you mentioned is another, I guess, I don't know if I would say that he homesteaded, but he's certainly somebody who's remembered from working in this area for many years. And I have a feeling we'll be hearing about next week, probably when Dark Side of the Ring comes out on Chris Colt, and that's Don Fargo.
Yeah, Fargo, it's just one of those, I think it's, if it wasn't homesteading, he sort of saw this as his safe, almost a home base type thing, that whatever trouble he got into in any other territory, if he had to leave quickly and he couldn't line up a new place to go, he would just come back. He would just call up Lee or Cowboy Bob and say, yeah, I need some work. And they would be happy to give it to him, because Don knew how to get heat. Absolutely. He's just a heat magnet. And yeah, I'm anticipating the Chris Colt Dark Side of the Ring, just to see how, you know, how much they get into his, shall we say, interesting life in and out of wrestling.
Definitely. And then that's somebody who stays around long enough, and I think people who listen to the podcast know I now have a newfound love of WoW. And Don Fargo was certainly one of the people that, from the limited TV that we have, is, you know, was sort of a mainstay, you know, both in the ring, and then eventually becomes a manager for it. I think it's Pat Rose and I think Marcel Pringle. I think one week they're like the Fabulous, they're not the Fabulous Bonds, but it's something like the Fabulous Bonds. And then the very next week Don has decided that they're the new Fabulous Fargos. And so, you know, there he is in like 1987 still on TV now, you know, being a manager and, you know, jostling with Rip Tyler, who was another guy who makes his name working in this territory.
Yeah, Rip Tyler and Eddie Sullivan were a big heel tag team in the early 70s here. Eddie Sullivan's real name was Ruben Huizar. There's actually at least three different wrestlers who used the ring name Eddie Sullivan at various times and in various places, and it gets confusing. But Sullivan and Tyler were regularly the tag team champions, or holding one of the many tag team championships in Gulf Coast. I think that's one of the things that we really should talk about, is how many different titles they had and how some of those titles did not have belts to signify the winners. But Mark, what did they have instead?
They had jackets.
How cool is that? Just like Augusta, Georgia winning the Masters, you have jackets because the titles were often city specific. So Hattiesburg would have the City of Hattiesburg tag team, you know, champions. So would Pensacola. So would, you know, Dothan. So would Pascagoula. They all had different tag team championships. And at some points, there was a storyline that if the same team held all the jackets at once, they would get a cash bonus. I don't know for sure if anyone got it or not, but typically what you see is in the different cities, Cowboy Bob Kelly and or Frank Dalton, who was another babyface, were often one half of the champions with someone else, and they would trade the titles back and forth with heel teams. So I guess the idea would be to see if Kelly and Dalton could ever get all the jackets at the same time.
Well, it certainly saves on your budget to just go and buy jackets rather than having belts made, even though we've seen like some of the belts in the 1970s are not the kind of belts that we're used to seeing in the 21st century.
Yeah, and you're less likely to have your jacket stolen at a Longhorn Steakhouse.
There's that, too.
Or if you do, it's not as big a deal.
Right. Some of the other people, we were saying before we started recording that one of the things that I really enjoy about these books is seeing guys at the beginning of their career that I did not realize had worked in this area. And just flipping through the book, like, two of the names that I immediately noticed were young Steve Kern and young Kevin Sullivan, although I think he wasn't Kevin Sullivan. I think at this point he had a different name.
Correct. He was not Kevin Sullivan at this point because of the aforementioned Eddie Sullivan had already been there. So when Sullivan comes here, because Sullivan had been wrestling as Kevin Sullivan prior to coming here, but they couldn't have another Sullivan, so they named him Johnny West.
Which is, yeah, it's just such a wonder. It's funny they didn't give him, like, some sort of gimmick Irish name.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure Sullivan's accent probably went over well in Pensacola and Mobile, I'm guessing.
I don't know how much he talked. He was often part of a tag team. And off the top, I'm trying to, without looking, with Ken Lucas. So this is the veteran teaming up with the young guy to give the young guy some seasoning and experience. So I would say as a babyface, upper mid-card tag team, they didn't do a ton of promos. And if they did, Lucas probably did a lot of the talking. And perhaps because of Sullivan's accent, they said, kid, don't say anything. The fans won't like your accent. It's very possible. But again, since we have little to no TV from this territory at this time, it's hard to know. But you see the picture of him in the book, and you can see it in the face. You can see it's Kevin Sullivan, but his hair, he's got sort of that the bowl haircut that some of the Beatles had in the early 60s.
Definitely. And it's funny that, again, it seems like Ken Lucas specialized in that sort of mentor, veteran, youngster tag team, since we all know that, you know, like maybe 10 years or so later, he would have that same relationship with Ricky Morton, especially in San Antonio, where, you know, they feuded with the Grapplers and other people.
Yeah, sometimes you just get that role of the tag team specialist, for lack of a better word, but also the veteran helping the young guys. And that's a nice spot to have, because there's always going to be young guys that need some help. Of course, Lucas also formed a tag team with Dennis Hall that was successful in Gulf Coast and also in Goulas and a few other places as well for many years. But he's also, you know, teaming up with a whole lot of different wrestlers. And like you said, several years later, Ricky Morton. I think also he broke in and teamed up with Ricky Gibson, the older brother of Robert Gibson.
Yeah, it's funny sometimes. I guess maybe you found this is true, that on my memory of certain people begins like when I started watching wrestling, which was like in 84, 85. So everything from before then is just sort of a nebulous prehistory where you're like, oh, I never knew this person worked in this place, or I never knew this person was a babyface who I was always known as a heel, or things like that. So it's funny when you, especially later when you start seeing a lot of those guys that came through Memphis in different combinations than like what we got, what we eventually became used to. Like, you know, seeing results from like 1982 in Memphis and seeing like here's Bobby Eaton as a babyface teaming with Ricky Morton versus, you know, like fighting Dennis Condrey and Stan Lane. You know, like it's these all these people that we associate with each other but in different combinations.
Right. Like, I love seeing like when Bob Slaughter and the Iron Sheik would cross paths in the AWA and then also in Central States in 1976. And of course, you know, years later, they have, you know, one of the biggest feuds going in 84, 85. It's just so cool to see all of these, you know, these ships passing at sea. And so many times their paths will cross early on, and then years later, they will have a famous run either as partners or as opponents.
And another young guy that I knew had worked here, but so like I'm interested to talk about, and that is, speaking of cowboys, the man who would later become Cowboy Ron Bass.
Yeah, the Bass family, and these are some of the earliest matches in the careers of Don Bass and Ron Bass, and they are managed by Ma Bass, who is former wrestler Mae Weston, who at this point in time in 1973 is 50 years old. At one point, Ron gets injured, so then Bobby Bass comes to the territory, and this was the first place he wrestled as Bobby Bass. Of course, he would become better known as No Class Bobby Bass, which is one of the great nicknames in wrestling of the 1980s. But, you know there's a Ron Bass and you know there's a Don Bass, but if you didn't start watching wrestling until the 80s, like you did and also like I did, you might not have known that they were put together as a brother team for many years. And they worked here in Gulf Coast. They also worked for McGurk and I think a couple of other places as well. And then Ron Bass ends up teaming up with Dutch Mantell as the Outlaws in Central States. And when they leave there, they come back to Gulf Coast, but this time they're billed as Ron Bass and Dutch Bass to keep the Bass family gimmick going.
Yeah, it's funny to, you know, Dutch is one of those people I think people just always assume as being Dutch. But, you know, to learn that he was Dutch Bass or that he was Chris Gallagher or, you know, wrestling under his real name early in his career, that... Yeah, it's, you know, that's why, you know, these books of yours, one of the things that's so great about them is learning all of this kind of stuff that you might not necessarily pick up other places. I just saw somebody else who I didn't realize had worked here. Oh, Armand Hussein, who I, you know, sort of attribute to being like in Oklahoma or Texas. Again, you know, right around the era that I started watching when he's with
Gary Hart.
When he's with Gary Hart and H&H International.
Yeah, and he had been wrestling for a while before all this. And that's what has always fascinated me about professional wrestling. When I first got in the 80s, of course, I grew up in the Northeast. So my earliest exposure was to TBS when I would visit my grandparents in Florida. But, you know, in New York, I would see the WWF more than anything else. But once I started reading the magazines and all that and finding other shows on cable, it just fascinated me that guys would go wrestle somewhere for 8 to 10 months and then go somewhere else and do the and sometimes they were in the same role as a mid-card heel, as a main event babyface, but sometimes they're in different roles and sometimes they have different names. That is what has always fascinated me about wrestling, and it's why I started charting the territories, because it literally, you know, I want to track the movement of these wrestlers, not just where they went, but what their role was, not just their gimmick, but were they a babyface or a heel? Were they a tag team or a single? Were they a main eventer, a preliminary wrestler? And look at how that changed as they moved from place to place. And you can see, you know, as we mentioned earlier, guys like Steve Kern and Kevin Sullivan, you can track their progress as they go to different places and slowly move up the cards. They might start in a big territory as a preliminary wrestler and then go to a place like Gulf Coast and get a little bit more of a push so that when they go back to the bigger territory, they can now, you know, be moved up the cards. And on TV, it would be explained that he's been away for a while, gaining experience, and now he's back. You know, welcome, you know, Kevin Sullivan.
Well, that's also, you know, as Cornette says on his pod too, it's like guys go away and quote unquote learn a new hold. Right. So, you know, you can come back and suddenly, especially if you were like a lower card guy, now you're maybe like a mid card or upper mid card, or now you went to the Carolinas and you like mastered the figure four, or, you know, probably most famously, you're Terry Gordy and you go to Japan and you learn the Asiatic spike, or as it was once called, the Oriental spike, you know, and then, you know, and from that, I think he learned from Killer Khan, which I think was part of their feud. And then I guess one of them must have taught it to Brian Adias, since he ended up using it in World Class.
Right. But, and you can also, those could be legitimate stories that happened, but also you could make it up. You could, you know, a lot of times they say this wrestler just came back from a world tour, you know, where he was undefeated in, you know, Australia and Myanmar.
Right.
And nowadays we can actually go online and look through old newspapers and verify that, no, he was not undefeated in Myanmar. But back then there was no way of checking that info out. You just trusted what Gordon Solie or Lance Russell or whoever said on TV.
A couple more interesting names that I'll get to before we move on is, we mentioned Don Fargo, but at this time Don Fargo had a brother, but we're not talking about Jackie and we're not talking about Roughhouse.
Yeah, we are talking about Johnny Fargo, who is Greg Valentine. Again, very early in his career. And just imagine, you know, you're the son of a famous wrestler and you decide to break in the business and says, okay, we're going to put you with Don Fargo, one of the craziest guys in the history of wrestling. The guy who, you know, literally more than once had to leave a territory in the middle of a big push and a big run because he got in trouble with the law. And I, you know, I just can't imagine Greg Valentine saying, well, this is awesome. This is for me. It's amazing that he didn't quit after, you know, 6 months.
It's kind of sort of the opposite of Bill Watts trying to find a nice steady mentor for the Freebirds and putting him with Buddy Roberts, not knowing, pardon the pun, that they would be birds of a feather and that he would fit in perfectly. But I guess, you know, also if you're Don Fargo, it's like, you know, how bad of an influence do you want to be on this kid? Because what happens if what happens if Johnny gets mad over something that happens to Greg and Johnny comes looking for you?
So that's a very good point that I didn't think about. Maybe that kept Don a little closer to the straight and narrow than he typically was known for. But my favorite story about Fargo is apparently there on more than one occasion he would recruit a new tag team partner by going to a bar and picking a fight with somebody. And if the guy, you know, did halfway decent in the fight with Fargo, Don would pick him up after beating his ass and say, "All right, kid, you're with me now. Next week, I'll get you some tights and boots, and you're going to be a wrestler now."
The funny thing is, Don Fargo left a couple of places because of running afoul of the law, and at least one occasion he had to leave because of the opposite. He ran afoul of a motorcycle gang.
Yeah, he did. He sure did. And that led to Kenny Mack getting shot. This was in Indianapolis. But also there was a time where Fargo and I think also Kenny Mack literally ended up participating in an initiation ceremony for a biker gang in Louisiana in 1968. And they literally, again, had to leave town in the middle of the night. Because they were hanging out with this biker gang who decided to, for lack of a better term, haze one of their probies or, you know, whatever you want to call them. And I think set them on fire in a bathtub or something crazy like that.
It's like, oh, these stories. Yeah, it's like, yes, how can you take wrestlers and give them even crazier stories? I know, let them hang around with motorcycle gangs in the 1970s.
Exactly. And yeah, it's whenever I talk about Don Fargo, I just love saying in a world where everybody was batshit crazy, Don Fargo was even more, you know, batshit crazier than all the others.
And then you stick him with Roughhouse Fargo, who was allegedly the actual crazy Fargo.
Yes, he was. You know, he was like in the A team. He was in the Nut House, and they had to sneak him out of the mental facilities. Every time, you know, and Roughhouse actually makes a cameo appearance in this book because Don, you mentioned originally he's with Johnny Fargo, Greg Valentine, although towards the end of his run, Fargo possibly gets hurt or possibly left town in the middle of the night and they just said he got hurt and is replaced by Jackie Fargo for a few shows. And then about a year or so later, Roughhouse Fargo comes in. So there in the early 70s, there is a long history of Fargos getting in trouble in Gulf Coast. And that's a recurring theme in Gulf Coast is these family ties, perhaps more so than any other territory. It's probably because of Lee Fields' background, originally teaming with his two brothers, and of course eventually having a son and at least one nephew that got into wrestling. Of course, his father being the promoter of the shows in Mississippi is you see so many family ties. Another young wrestler early on here is Randy Colley, a future Moondog, who is here as a member of the Dalton family, along with Jim Baugus, who was Jim Dalton. Randy Colley is playing the role of Jack Dalton, which years earlier in Gulf Coast had been Don Fargo's gimmick here. But they're here as heels, and they're feuding with alleged family member Frank Dalton, who's a babyface.
And that's something we would eventually see once the Fullers come back, where you have, at any one time, you know, Ron may be a babyface or a heel. Jimmy Golden may be a babyface or a heel. Rob, which is funny, it's something I didn't realize, that Rob had always been a babyface until he famously turned on Bob Armstrong in the cage. Because I think, like you, I grew up always thinking of Robert Fuller as you know, being Tennessee Stud Robert Fuller, because I never saw Ron until years later. So, like, it's weird now to see, like, young, fresh meat, white meat babyface Robert Fuller, because it's so, like, against how I'm used to thinking of him.
Right, let alone someone like Kevin Sullivan, who I think when I first got into wrestling had just started doing the devil gimmick or whatever you want to call it in Florida. So to see him as a clean-cut Johnny West in Gulf Coast, or even clean-cut Kevin Sullivan, or, you know, bodybuilder Kevin Sullivan in Florida teaming up with Mike Graham, it's a culture shock. But that's what these wrestlers had to do to get longevity out of their careers is they had to constantly reinvent themselves and find ways to level up and move up the cards. And the best way to achieve that is by taking on a new role, either by turning or by just, you know, taking on a different gimmick. And that's how wrestlers would be able to, you know, keep going to the same place year after year after year without getting stale.
And speaking of Kevin Sullivan in this area, although it'll be years later, the last two people that I was interested to see apparently, I guess, started their careers around this time are the Samoans, but not the Samoans that we think of as the Samoans.
Yeah, there's a few different Samoans, and what's really funny is in the early 70s, they're crisscrossing the country. Neither of the two Samoan teams seem to be staying in the same place for very long, and there are a lot of times where, you know, it's hard to really know which version you have. Again, that's one of the interesting things about wrestling history is we think we know where Afa and Sika were at all times, but sometimes we don't. And here we have two Samoans, and they were Tapu, but the other Samoan was not someone normally associated with Tapu. He typically teamed with two wrestlers named Tio and Reno Tafuli, but here his partner is someone by the name of Ati Tago, who I think becomes, I don't think he's Coco Samoa, but I think he, one of the things about this book is I also list their well-known aliases, so let's see if I can look that up real quick and see if he does have another known alias. No, his real name, according to the Alabama Athletic Commission, was Ati Ivalin, but his most well-known ring name was Ati Tago. And then the other one was Tapu, who sometimes wrestled as Prince Tapu and sometimes as Chief Tapu.
And then, as we said, later they would come back years later in this area with Kevin Sullivan, but not as – he was not a Samoan. He was now a New Guinea headhunter.
Right.
one of my favorite angles of all time, which, you know, I didn't get to see live because this is, I think, like 1987 or 1988, whichever it was. But I remember seeing the clip on Pro Wrestling This Week where Sullivan had come in and was running roughshod, and Ron was gone at this point, and Sullivan turns on Ron Fuller, and so you start this feud with the Stud Stable versus the Headhunters, and they're in a cage, and Sullivan is doing commentary with Gordon Solie, and it's like, you know, Gordon's doing the whole, well, it's finally a 2-on-2 match, and they're inside the cage, and you can't interfere, Mr. Sullivan, and blah, 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 blah. And then they start ripping up the ring. And lo and behold, there's a third headhunter underneath. Which leads, you know, because in Sullivan, in his great, we talked about Sullivan's accent, he goes, what is it, Mr. Solie? It's another headhunter, Mr. Solie. which then leads to, you know, them destroying. I don't know if it was Ron and Robert or Robert and Jimmy, but so that eventually leads to them having 6-man matches in the cage, which would lead to the famous, like a couple months later, lead to the match when they're all in the cage. Although now they've added Buddy to this mix, but that's the night when they debuted Doug Furness in Knoxville, and he ripped the cage door off to save the babyfaces. Doug Furness, a University of Football star, comes to the ring and rips the cage door off, which is where Cornette saw that and later used that when he was in the WWF with Kane. So, like, and again, Kane debuted from coming under the ring. So, again, like you said, all ideas are cyclical.
Yeah, these were things that worked very well in this era. Of course, nowadays probably it's just a completely different business model and everything. But And also, these were not necessarily things that they had planned out for months in advance, that it was going to build to this and this and this. It's just a matter of seeing who you've got, who's here, and what we can do. All right, now we need a way to put some more heat on the headhunters. Let's find, you know, let's see if we can get another guy that kind of looks like him, and we'll make them a third headhunter. This is, you know, isn't always something that has been planned out for months and months to peak at a pay-per-view or at a big show. This is just, what can we do this week to get the fans to come back next week?
And as we were saying, the business is a lot more volatile there too, where what do you do if you're building to this main event feud and your star gets hurt, leaves the territory for whatever reason? Again, we mentioned running afoul of the law was a not unusual occurrence in wrestling, certainly back in those days. I mean, I guess the most famous example may be, you know, that Ole was building up Arn Anderson and Matt Bourne to be the Georgia Tag Team Champions. Matt Bourne has his issues, has to abscond in the night. He no longer has any tag teams, and he suddenly has these two bouncer guys from Minnesota, and the Road Warriors are born. Purely out of serendipity.
Yeah, it's like sometimes they, you know, these are happy accidents that are just, you know, necessitated by circumstances out of anybody's control. Or even, you know, I thought you were, when you're talking about one of the most famous examples, I thought you were going to talk about when Junkyard Dog left Mid-South. Without giving them the ample time to, you know, use him in such a way on the way out that makes sense. They just have to get out and say, oh, he decided to leave. And, you know, but the answer is, what do you do when someone leaves or gets hurt? You come up, the booker comes up with a creative angle to tie in something new to, you know, to explain it. They can say the guy was injured. They can say, you know, he just decided not to show up again. You just, like I said earlier, you just throw something at the wall. And sometimes, in the case of the Road Warriors, it most definitely stuck.
Yeah, and there, you know, they, I don't remember how quickly after he left they turned Butch Reed. The first of many examples where Bill Watts tries to replicate the success of the Junkyard Dog. Right. And Butch Reed was probably the most successful of them because it was somebody who was already there, and, you know, again, history is written by the victor. History is often written in wrestling by whoever the owner is when the guy leaves. So he can say the Junkyard Dog was scared of Butch Reed and left to go up north where the competition isn't as strong, you know, as opposed to, you know, eventually trying with George Wells and Brickhouse Brown and Savannah Jack and, you know, probably a couple others, the Snowman.
Right.
But luckily, he already had Butch Reed there, and, you know, Butch Reed had certainly held his own against Junkyard Dog over the course of however many years they had feuded with each other. I mean, I don't think, you know, I would probably call that, you know, we'd have to get Greg to weigh in on this, on whether they were seen as equals in the eyes of the fans, especially the New Orleans fans that the Junkyard Dog's fan base was built around. But yes, you know, they were, because I don't know if Reed had been North American champion yet at that point. I think he had been. But so, you know, they were fairly equal. But again, yeah, that's the problem. It's like not everybody did the honors that they say, especially when Vince started, quote unquote, poaching talent. You know, some guys gave their notice. And, you know, famously, we mentioned Greg Valentine, where, you know, he was already appearing like at WWF TV tapings, yet was still like working out his deal in the Carolinas. So you had this weird thing where he was kind of in both places at once.
But that was typical for the WWF in the very early 80s, because they would have someone work TVs only for a long period of time before putting them on the road. In fact, there's a couple of examples where I think tag team titles changed hands before that the whoever won the titles were actually on the road. So what they would do would be they would work Tuesdays and Wednesdays up north, and then go back and do wherever they were working. They would just do the house show loops for whatever territory they were finishing up in. So that wasn't out of the normal. And a lot of time, you know, just again, back then, what was shown on the WWF TV wasn't shown anywhere else. Of course, cable starts to change that in the late 70s and much more so in the early 80s, which is why Vince was able to do what he did, because he needed guys and he needed them now. And he just offered them the world and they took it.
Definitely. Oh, before we close out our time at Gulf Coast, just because I'm flipping through the book and looking at stuff, is the Pascagoula Plowboy Stan Frazier?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
He shows up periodically, and he's used similarly to how Haystack or Andre are used in other territories. He's never really here full time for months on end. He might come in for a few weeks. He might do a couple of one shots just to build a big angle or do some battle royals.
I would say, speaking of people with many gimmicks, Stanford. Yeah. And so he was not quote unquote discovered by Jerry Lawler. Although I guess it may be true. He was driving through Mississippi and saw this giant hillbilly or whatever. Like, maybe he was actually on a show and saw this giant hillbilly and said, "Hey, we could use you in Memphis. Come here and sell some of your jewelry."
Right. Again, a lot of times the storylines in wrestling have elements of truth in them. And you typically the best ones do. It might not be that Stan had never wrestled before, but perhaps that Lawler saw him in Mississippi has parts of truth to it.
One I forgot about before we go. Was Mike Boyette a hippie at this point, or is he just Mike Boyette?
No, he is a hippie.
Okay.
Hippies were the scourge of the South in the early 70s. But what's fascinating is that he gets over huge as a babyface doing the hippie gimmick. He first comes in as a heel, but then he turns babyface, and as best I can tell, was incredibly over and successful, which is just surprising to me, because you do see at this time, you know, if you put yourself in the early 70s in the South, the cowboys and whatnot are disgusted by these liberal hippies from California or whatever. So it's an easy way for a wrestler to get heat as a heel by calling themselves a hippie. But Boyette was somehow able to become a top babyface in that role.
Because you can't always predict how the fans will react to a gimmick. That's one of the great things about wrestling.
Yeah, and you, sometimes you lead the fans in a certain direction, or sometimes they start it, and then you just work with them and work with it. But in the beginning of 1971, Boyette is a heel. He ends up, I think he does an injury angle, and then leaves for a month or two and comes back and starts working on the babyface side of things.
Cool. One of the things I noticed while flipping through the book is that you've got the results for the year by, day by day, often supplemented with the clippings that you found from the local newspapers. And this is something that I had dabbled in the past with, but up until recently for this project that I'm working on, I officially dove into the waters that you and Greg Klein and so many others are doing, and that is miningnewspapers.com for wrestling results. But I guess this is like a process question, as we say when we have like comic people on. When you go and do your research, how much would you say is just based on finding stuff online, and how much of it is you actually when you go on field trips and do the research on the ground?
Well, I've sort of honed my method over the years, but the idea is cities of a certain size are more likely to have had regular wrestling. And originally I started with the results aggregator sites that were already out there, like WrestlingData.com and CageMatch.net, and results books that had been written by Mark James or by Dick Bourne or what have you, and you put together a list of known house shows. And then from there, you find out if that newspaper is available online, and you can pull the clips yourself. But then from there, I studied demographic and population data to try and identify towns that were large enough to sustain weekly wrestling that weren't mentioned in these results sites or books. And I found several towns like Fort Smith, Arkansas, Texarkana, or just ones where we know there was regular wrestling, but the newspapers aren't available online. So I would go visit either that local public library or a state, a central location in the state that has microfilm of newspapers for pretty much every city and every paper within the state. And it's not just the size of the city or town, but it's also whether or not they're part of a larger metropolitan area or TV market. Because when you think about how these territories promoted their wrestling events, aside from the newspapers, it's the TV. And by and large, the TV that airs in one market, let's say Dothan, Alabama, is looking to plug one house show every week. So if we know they're running a house show in Dothan, then we can be pretty certain that any other city or town that would receive that TV signal probably wasn't having regular wrestling. So I've worked with I have actually old TV journals that literally state on a county by county basis which TV market they're all in, and I've used all that to sort of identify new towns, and I've had some success in going out and finding previously undocumented house show listings that from this, like Pascagoula was actually one of them. There was really not much about Pascagoula as opposed to the other Mississippi towns, but thanks to my work and my visit to the Mississippi Historical Center in Jackson, I was able to find clippings for that.
Has there been a place geographically where you've had better success than others in finding all these results? Is it just that, say, the AWA, because it's in a lot of major Midwestern cities, that was easier than, like, say, Gulf Coast, where we're dealing with relatively small towns? Even the big towns there are kind of small, especially in the 70s?
It's, again, typically I do my research before going somewhere, so by and large, I know what I'm expecting to find, and every now and then, there is a needle in the haystack, but by and large, I'm going somewhere knowing what I'm going to get, because I've already worked through the process of what's the population, what metropolitan area is it a part of, what TV market is a part of, so I have a much more targeted approach, as opposed to saying, well, I'm just going to go to, Texas and see what I can find. If I'm going to go to Texas, I, know what I'm looking for, and typically I find about what I expected.
I know I've been, the stuff that I've been looking at is sort of for like the West Texas State stuff that I've been trying to look for. I've been trying to do research on the football careers of the people that played at West Texas State before they became wrestlers.
Right.
So, yeah, so luckily, like, the newspaper for Canyon, Texas, which is where West Texas State is, although, it's now no longer West Texas State, but, luckily the Canyon, Texas newspaper is part of newspapers.com, so that's been good. Like, I haven't even, gone up a level to look at the Amarillo paper shit, which I assume would be sort of, probably the closest, since that's where the Amarillo territory was based out of, that's like my sort of next step to start looking at stuff. But luckily, the Canyon paper is there, and I posted this on Twitter, which I found wonderfully funny, because I know this is something you've talked about on the show. The story is that a bunch of the West Texas State football players were involved in a auto accident, quote unquote, while driving on the Funk Ranch, including Terry. Terry allegedly, while he was playing for the West Texas State football team, him and some of his buddies had gone to Dory Senior's ranch and were doing whatever they were doing on the ranch and ran into a ditch or something like that, and Terry got a concussion. And this is, you know, I think like 1960-something. And so it's just funny, you know, since we all know the history about the Funk family and wrestlers being involved in car accidents on the Funk Ranch. So, like, that may be why, like, when it came time to tell that story, if it didn't actually happen, you know, Dory could go, hey, remember Terry was in a car accident once on the ranch and got a concussion. Maybe the same happened to Dory, only he hurt his shoulder, so he can't drop the title to Harley Race.
That could be sometimes, as we mentioned earlier, sometimes the inspiration for the falsehoods in wrestling come from real events. Now, in the case of Dory Jr., it's hard to know exactly what happened, and no one will ever know. I know Dave Meltzer thinks he knows, but I do believe the accident was legitimate. How hurt Dory Jr. was is another story altogether. We do know he made a booking in Hawaii within a couple of days afterwards. That doesn't mean anything. He probably, the tickets were, you know, he already had the flight booked. It was probably a huge payoff, so he may very well have gutted through a legitimate injury. Again, that's the thing with wrestling, is these are guys whose whole lives were based around perpetuating a falsehood. And even Terry, for a few decades, would maintain that his professional wrestling debut was in Amarillo against Sputnik Monroe. It was only until a couple of nerds like you and I found some things on newspapers.com that listed him for a match a few days prior to that, that he did an interview coming clean. And actually, he said his first match was one that nobody else had known about. It was the Saturday before his Thursday debut in Amarillo, where he worked a tag match opposite. He mentioned Jack Kane, who was a referee at the time doing a heel ref gimmick. And it was in, I believe, Littlefield, Texas. And it was the week after West Texas State's season ended in Terry's senior year. Because, of course, in that era, he wouldn't have risked wrestling prior to that because he would have lost his eligibility.
Which, as we said earlier, Ron Fuller wrestled under a mask while he was still enrolled at Miami, because him being a pro wrestler would have violated his scholarship for being a exactly. basketball player at Miami, which is, it's sort of funny, you know, when you flash forward now and, you know, athletes are, like, you have NILs and people are getting paid and doing commercials. Like, to me, it's very weird to see, like, college athletes now doing commercials.
Right. But also, not that long after all this, Doc, Steve Williams, did wrestle in the offseason in between his junior and senior years. He did wrestle in the summer for Watts. So whatever was in place in the 60s that affected Terry and Ron apparently was no longer an issue by 82-83.
I think, if I remember right, although this may not necessarily be true for Doc, but I think eventually the rule was you could be a professional in one sport,
not your sport.
Right, like, say, like, if you were Danny Ainge, you could play college baseball in the summer in the minor leagues in the Blue Jays farm system while not losing your basketball eligibility.
That's very possible.
I think it's – I don't know if it's that was true in the 80s. I think that was eventually true, because there was somebody, I think, that famously did that, that was like a multi-sport kind of athlete that did both. And yeah, and it's funny, I guess, and you would not also put it past Bill Watts to come on TV and explain that Doc is competing in pro wrestling, however, we are withholding his purse and putting it in a bank account so that once he loses all of his eligibility, he will then collect the money as if it was like a trust fund.
And if they had needed to do that, that could have been a way around it. But as we said, I think by then the rules were such that it was less of an issue. And also, it might have been because pro wrestling was looked at differently even by the early 80s. I know we think it wasn't until 86, 87 that it was more publicly acknowledged. But it's possible by the early 80s they said, yes, these rules should be in place for college athletes, but pro wrestling is different.
Because was it – see, what Olympic – there was one of the Olympics when, Yokiyatsu Yatsu was going to compete, or is going to try and make the Japanese Olympic wrestling team, but he couldn't because he was a pro wrestler. But again, that's also a different country.
Right.
But I remember famously Yatsu like was going to leave All Japan, New Japan, whichever one he was working for at the time, to train. Sort of how, like, remember when Kurt Angle was going to, like, I think, like, leave the WWF and, like, maybe retry to, like, try to make the Olympic team again or something like that.
Yeah.
But, so Yatsu was going to do that, but then they, like, ruled that he couldn't. But, yeah, that Watts thing made me think of that's, I think it was Watts. No, I guess it was in a bunch of places where they would do, when they would go on TV and explain how you paid masked wrestlers. The thing where, like, we send the money to a P.O. box and it's a money order and it's like, because it's like, how can you cash a check if you're a master? You know, that whole thing where, you know, there's a long convoluted explanation about how you pay mass wrestlers or something like that, other than just probably just saying you pay them in cash.
Right.
But, it's one of those. But, no, like we were talking, one of the things that we talked about when Bo was on, like, a show or two ago was, and I'm sure you can talk about this at length, is the trouble of being, one of the troubles of being a wrestling historian is this is a business built on a lie, and everything about it is exaggerated or fudged. So again, you know, like when you see results in the newspaper, you assume they're probably correct, but they may not be. You know, the box office probably isn't 100%. It may not even be 100% if we have the records from the State Athletic Commission. But it's like everything is, you kind of have to take everything in this business with a pinch of salt, especially when you're a historian trying to figure out the quote-unquote truth of something.
Right. And so what I try and do, I try and use objective sources. I like to say, if I'm looking for some factual information about professional wrestlers, the last thing I want to do is ask a professional wrestler.
Right.
So my approach is similar to the folks that did the book and then podcast series called Freakonomics, where they use actual data, or also what Sabermetrics was. They use data to disprove the old wives' tales that baseball coaches and scouts used to have, with things like a walk is as good as a hit. Well, the baseball, the analytics folks prove that in most situations is not true. So what we do here, and that's also the reason why you mentioned in the book, I use newspaper clippings instead of just typing out this guy beat this guy. Because a lot of times when you read these results, sometimes it's not very clear what the actual, let's say, box score of a match was. And a lot of times they list very, details, so-and-so pinned this guy or this, he was disqualified for doing this. But in some cities, they just say, this guy beat this guy, this guy beat this guy, this guy drew this guy. We can't prove for a fact that those were pinfall finishes. If for an entire card they don't list anything about disqualifications, we just don't know that's the case. And then a lot of times, it's I don't want to say wrestling results don't matter. What I would say is this: what happened during a wrestling match matters as it pertains to what happened previously or what's going to happen the next week. And a lot of times, a box score doesn't tell you what happened. And in particular, in Mobile, Alabama, they have very detailed descriptions of what goes on. And what you see is, particularly in the main events, there's shenanigans no matter what. Even if the babyface wins over the heel by pinfall, that doesn't mean that it was a clean win after his finishing move. There's usually all sorts of shenanigans going on, and a lot of times it's about what happens either leading up to the finish or after the finish that's relevant, because it sets up what happens next week. And what I've done in this book, for times where we don't have the results, we actually can look at the stipulations for rematches and make educated guesses as to what happened. For example, let's say one town had a title match where the heel was defending against the babyface, and then the following week they have a rematch for the title with a 90-minute time limit. Mark, without knowing the finish for the first match, can you guess what it was?
I'm guessing it may have been a draw.
Exactly. It went 60 minutes, thus necessitating them to have an extended time limit for the rematch. So a lot of what I do in this book, when I look at some of the biggest feuds in the towns where we don't have results, is I offer my, you know, my, I guess, expert analysis based on the match stipulations as to what I think happened. And that's also something I do with the attendance figures for Alabama in 1973. We actually don't have attendance figures, but we do have the amount of taxes paid to the state. And using that information and knowing what the percentage paid to the state was, I not only extrapolate what the gate probably was, but using the average ticket prices, I can then from there estimate the attendance. But of course, as you said, if they're shorting the commission and they're pocketing a whole lot of money, then those figures are understated. But at the very least, it gives us a broad general idea of which shows were drew more than the others.
And one of the things that I know you mentioned often on the podcast is talking about history is sort of the big grain of salt that you have to take with something like title histories. Because, like, what we've always thought sort of may not be true because you had title switches in towns where it wasn't promoted or reversed or something like that that aren't considered part of an official history. But you've uncovered results that show that maybe some guy in one town had a belt that was never acknowledged on the TV or something. Or in Gulf Coast jackets.
Right. Or perhaps it was only acknowledged in that market. In Leroy McGurk's territory, there are a few times, maybe two or three, where Danny Hodge loses the NWA World Junior Heavyweight title in Little Rock or Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and gets it back a few weeks later. But those title changes are not acknowledged anywhere else in the territory. What I like to say is this: a wrestler who held multiple titles in multiple territories over the course of his career, likely that is because they were a good wrestler, either technically or a good box office draw. But the calculus behind any singular title change often involves other factors. We talked about wrestlers leaving or wrestlers getting injured. In the case of Danny Hodge, I think your listeners know of his 1976 car accident that led to him pretty much retiring and having to forfeit the NWA World Junior Heavyweight title. But there were two other occasions where it appears that car accidents that Hodge got into necessitated title changes that may not have happened had he not been injured. And one of them involved Ramon Torres. Torres ends up winning the World Junior Heavyweight title from Dr. X in a match that was billed as Hodge versus X. And it's interesting that that happened to Ramon Torres because that same year he gets a run with the Nebraska heavyweight title. But I think the only reason he got that title, it was sort of a make good for his brother passing away earlier in the year after a match in Nebraska against Tom Andrews as the Claw.
And I don't know how often it happens, say, in United States territories, but we certainly know of, you know, the Caribbean title changes that Flair had mainly to prevent riots.
Right. And just because Luthes never came forward and said he did those, how do we know this wasn't a regular thing? And it's funny you mentioned the Flair title because I actually, years ago, the place I live in now, I was having drinks with one of my neighbors, and he was from the Dominican Republic. And when I mentioned that I was, wrestling at that point, I don't think I was a historian yet, but I mentioned my involvement in pro wrestling in the past. And he said, "Oh, you must know Jack Veneno." Literally to him growing up there at that time, he had no idea it was a quote unquote fake title change that never got acknowledged. This literally was billed up as the local star becoming champion of the world and a huge deal. And to them, they didn't know, you know, that this was just a unique set of circumstances that sort of, you know, where Flair called an audible on the spot. So these title changes, and again, when I mentioned earlier to the fans in Little Rock, Arkansas, Sputnik Monroe, beat Danny Hodge, and 3 weeks later lost it back to him to a fan in Little Rock. That is as legitimate a title change as any other. But to a fan in Monroe or Shreveport, Louisiana, they have no awareness that it exists. And thus, for any market where we don't have results, and Jackson, Mississippi is a good example in McGurk's territory, we have no idea if they did any of these title changes in Jackson. But it's always possible. So again, title histories for many years, because there was no other quantitative data to analyze wrestlers, that's what people became attached to. And I like to think that because of my work with developing statistics like the spot rating, that we now have another tool to evaluate a wrestler's level of success or you know, what their role was in different territories at different times.
Definitely. And there's just, again, there's so many weird gray areas in this business that, again, for somebody who deals with numbers like you do, like, you know, you had to invent quantitative statistics to try and prove, again, you know, I mean, this is certainly a debate we have in 2024. What's a quote-unquote good match? You know what I mean? It's like, it's also just like, what's a good movie?
Right, and those are subjective. And, you know, box office data, if we're talking about movies, you know, is a little more objective. But, you know, my whole thing in comparing wrestlers to actors, and I think I said this on my podcast several months ago, I have no desire to see Vin Diesel doing Shakespeare in the Round. But you put him in a movie with cars crashing and bridges falling, and I'm first in line. So Vin Diesel is not a good actor, but he is a box office star. And I sort of look at pro wrestling the same way. Well, you know, and I guess the most, you know, polarizing example of Hall of Fame worthy or not is Junkyard Dog. Was Junkyard Dog a good wrestler in the way that Vin Diesel was a good actor? No. But is Junkyard Dog a successful professional wrestler in the same way that Vin Diesel is a successful movie star? Absolutely. And so it's just a matter of which of those criteria is more important to you, his technical prowess, his abilities, or his ability to put asses in seats.
Right. You know, you can have the world's greatest Broadway actor, and if you put him in a movie that no one cares about, you know, he may not get to be, you know, he may be going right back to Broadway.
Yeah. You know, someone like Kenneth Branagh, who's a renowned actor of theater and did a little bit of acting in the movies, but ended up becoming a director as well. But I always say, because he directed the first Thor. And so, of course, he was smart enough to realize that he's going to need a big hunky guy who might not be the, you know, the most acclaimed, accomplished thespian. But he found Hemsworth, and I think Hemsworth did a pretty good job with the role.
Right. And then it's funny where Branagh made lots of successful Shakespeare movies that he was in, but like his first sort of like Hollywood movie, which was this, you may remember, this was like sort of quasi Hitchcock like thriller called Dead Again. Was, I thought, good, but at the time I remember talking to one of my film professors who just like thought it was laughable that like people were comparing it to Wells and Hitchcock. He's just like, you've got to be kidding me. And mainly this professor was also a Wells scholar, so perhaps comparing like this new movie to an Orson Welles film may not have been the best person to say it to. But it is somebody who just eventually, I guess now that, you know, that he's playing Poirot and directing, so he's, again, it's the advantage of if you're a director, it's like, who's the best person to play this part? Why, I'm going to do this worldwide search and end up picking myself. Which, in a way, is a lot like wrestling, where when you're the booker, you know, it's like, who on this crew can I depend on the most? Myself,
yeah.
So that's,
or if you're Gary Hart, Don Jardine.
Right.
Or if you're Harley Race, Roger Kirby.
Or Mike George.
George, yeah. So that's just sort of the way wrestling works. So again, it's about trying to come up with more ways to quantify wrestlers' roles beyond just title histories or Madison Square Garden sellouts, because again, we have so little in the way of attendance data for the majority of house shows. It's really hard to use that as a barometer. So we're just coming up with other ways. Again, if a guy is given a main event in a territory and you find he stays in main events for a long time, that's an indication that he drew well when put in that role, or nepotism, one or the other.
Right. Again, who can you depend on? Well, hopefully your family. So, yeah. And again, wrestling, you know, if nothing about the history of wrestling, it's a series of family businesses.
It is. Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, Vince Sr. And Vince Jr. or the 20-odd, 30-odd members of the Fuller dynasty on various generational levels, or the Von Erichs,
the Grahams, the Ganyas, the Harts, the list goes on and on. And if you want to count fake brothers, the Shires, of course, Shire brought in Ray Stevens, who had been Ray Shire teaming with him.
But yeah, I mean, it's one of those weird things where, like, when you talk about, and there's no, you know, past results do not, in future indicators. It's like you've got all of these second or third generation families, and it's like, you know, it's funny, you know, the Funks had Amarillo and were had two of the best second generation wrestlers ever. Yet, unfortunately, they were in a territory that probably was not going to succeed once we get to the era of national expansion, and they were like some of the first people to see the writing on the wall and get out of the business.
And they were also making so much money in Japan and elsewhere that they would be better off not having, that territory to have to deal with.
Right. And then you've got, and then you end up, and on the other hand, you have Nick Gulas, who unfortunately, may have arguably, on the other end of the scale for second generation wrestlers, you have George. I posted something funny when I was looking for results recently that it was, there was a team. It was the Jet Set.
Yeah, Gulas and Eaton.
It was the Jet Set and Andre versus the Freebirds.
Okay.
And like the late, and I remember I like posted something on Twitter, like I think I tagged Cornette, and I was like, I wonder if like Bobby ever mentioned this match where he teamed with George Gulas and Andre versus the Freebirds. It's such a wacky wrestling spectacle to think about.
Okay, so let me ask you this, and I'm gonna ask a question that I don't know the answer to, but as much as George Gulas is maligned, did he draw? Has anyone? I'm tempted to say the answer is no, but there were other reasons why Nick's territory was dying. But if he was over and he drew and he sucked, does it matter? Again, as we talked about earlier, if there's a shitty actor that keeps having box office smashes, he's going to keep getting, he's going to keep getting good roles. So as much as it's fun to not, knock him, I know for many years people love to knock Greg Gagne because he looks bland. But goddamn, Greg was an amazing wrestler, and the High Flyers drew really, really well. And there's documented proof of that. So so if you want to knock George Gulas, I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm saying, has anyone really dug into attendance, verifiable attendance figures, to figure out if he was so bad that the fans were turned off, or if the fans just still, got into it? Because in wrestling, you are telling fans who the big stars are. You are able to push guys as top stars, and a lot of times fans will eat what you serve them with a spoon.
I don't know. That's an interesting question that I may have to
ask.
No, but I guess, see, I sort of agree with you that I've often thought Greg Gagne was maligned a little too. I think one of the problems with Greg Gagne is, one, like, people in the business apparently did not like him, especially like when he worked for WCW. And I don't know like how his demeanor was as an executive in the AWA, but I wonder part of it is that the first exposure many people got to Greg Gagne was Rambo Greg Gagne as part of Team Slaughter. And like that right. sort of, you know, tarnished his how you remember him, much like, you know, as great a wrestler as Terry Taylor was, unfortunately, you know, like the first line in Terry Taylor's obituary to most wrestling fans is going to mention the Red Rooster.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
So it's like one, I'm sure there's other examples, like one bad gimmick can, you know, one good gimmick can make your career, but one bad gimmick
can erase, you know, years and years of goodwill and good work.
I mean, you know, the fact that, you know, Kevin Nash managed to overcome being like a Master Blaster and then Oz is actually, you know, he's very fortunate that, you know, Vinny Vegas was a more, probably closer to his personality, as we would like later see, and, you know, got just enough of a push on TV that when he jumped, and then, you know, and then he was big and charismatic and Vince liked him, that he got a push, you know, and the rest is history. But it's very possible he could have been one of the many horrible green guys that like Ole signed in that time that just never went anywhere. You know, again, wrestling is weirdly fickle and you just never know what's going to happen.
It's sometimes it's about timing. If you're Ramon Torres, like I said earlier, it's just about having been on the card the night that Danny Hodge apparently got in a car accident on the way to the show. And because I said earlier that it was Dr. X, it was actually Roger Kirby, and Kirby was finishing up at that time. So they couldn't wait, you know, and see if Hodge would get better or be able to come back. They had to take the title off Kirby. And also as a make good to the fans, since they had advertised Hodge, they decided to do a title change.
Well, I mean, for all of your years that you worked as a manager, I'm sure you saw guys who you thought, you know, had it, but for whatever reason didn't make it. Was it because, you know, there were no more territories or they were good but not big enough or whatever? Like, you know, I'm sure like you may have managed or worked against guys and you're like, this guy is great, but it just never went anywhere.
Yeah, tons of guys, especially as you said, after the territories dwindled away, there's no ways to level up, which was, you know, something we talked about earlier that guys like Sullivan and Valentine did by coming to Gulf Coast. There's, you know, there's just the small time or the big time. And there's very little in between. I think nowadays there's a lot more middle ground with some of the more premier indies. But back in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was either you're an indie guy or you're a signed guy. And it's very hard to get to one to the other without a lot of timing and luck and just being in the right place at the right time. You know, a funny story. I was actually telling somebody about this the other night. I was booking for NWA Anarchy in Cornelia, Georgia, shortly after Wildside had folded. We were using a wrestler named Randall Johnson. And one time he bought another young guy with him that had just started wrestling, and we had an open spot, so I gave to this guy. This young man was the most polite wrestler I have ever encountered in a wrestling dressing room in my life. And I remember saying to myself, this kid is so nice, he will never make in this business. There's not a chance. That young man was Heath Slater.
Who... You know,
at the time was Heath Miller, but
right.
A few years later, boy, was I surprised to see him in FCW, and then again, you know, go on to get a nice little run and make a nice little career for himself.
That's like, I mean, for the brief time that like I worked behind the scenes in Maryland, it was like, you know, we had local guys who were really good, but you know, had, especially this is true in indie wrestling, had day jobs, and yep. So they liked wrestling. But, you know, probably knew they didn't necessarily have a future, so they were happy, you know, working two or three times a month. And then we had, you know, when I was working in Baltimore, it's like Christian York and Joey Matthews, like, had started to come up from the Carolinas. You know, so like they were working, you know, in the Mid-Atlantic then, which led to them going to ECW. So they were in ECW when it folded. You know, and then Joey gets picked up by the WWF and then gets sent to OVW, and he gets becomes part of M&M and becomes a big star for a couple years. You know, and then, you know, and then transitions to being an agent. You know, but like, had you told me in like 1999 that like one of these guys in the locker room was going to end up becoming like a WWF agent and would have like multiple runs on Raw and SmackDown as a tag team champion, I don't know who I would have picked. And that's nothing against Joey, because Joey was really good. But
you also had Pat Kenny there. You had Julio Sanchez. You had Cicero. You had Q-Ball. You had a lot of really talented guys. Maybe none of them had the size of the previous era, but they were all at the right time where that was changing. They were all also geographically optimal. Where they were stationed out of gave them good opportunities to go up north for ECW or to go a little further south for WCW. And in the case of Joey, you know, he originally was from Northern Virginia, but he moved down to Rayford, North Carolina, actually lived across the street from Carino at one point. And so that having the home base in Northern Virginia, but also then living in North Carolina, gave him exposure to work in a lot more places than if you're just in one place in Northern Virginia. So a lot of times that geographic flexibility and just being in the right place at the right time is what led to Joey getting the opportunity and not, for example, Cicero.
Right, because, again, like where I am, there were so many people who worked the Maryland Indies but also worked – all the Philadelphia Indies or the Pennsylvania Indies for Blaine DeSantis. You know, I mean, like, I would see the same people, like, the same handful of people in, like, five or six, maybe more, different companies, you know, that worked in Baltimore for Mark and Danny, who worked in Delaware for Jim Kettner, who worked for Blaine in, like, central Pennsylvania. And then, like, all the promoter, you know, everybody in Philly, especially once ECW died. You know, I mean, like, you know, as great as, like, Reckless was, you know, I don't know if I would necessarily, you know, there's a guy who had all the talent, but, you know, wasn't the biggest guy, you know, and eventually was in developmental, but, you know, it never really happened.
And had a good, not just a day job, but a good day career.
Right. There's that.
But yeah. But also, you know, the other thing, a lot of those guys that you mentioned would also come down and work for my pal Count Grog, Greg Masoriak in North Carolina. And it's just a matter of, because someone like Joey or Carino was often going back and forth and living in the Northeast or living in the South. If you know, he's stationed in the Northeast and Grog wants to bring him in, well, Steve's going to need to book a carload to make it worth it. So that's how guys like Joey or a Nightstick Eddie Brown would work more areas than, you know, just within their 60-mile radius.
Definitely. Before you go, I certainly want to make sure that we at least take a couple of minutes to say baseball has started again. You, in the first week of the season, you've already made a road trip to follow your Atlanta professional baseball team around.
I have, yeah. Earlier this week, I flew up to Chicago and I went to see the Braves against the White Sox. It started raining in the bottom of the sixth, and I will be very, very clear. As soon as I felt that first raindrop, I ran towards the door because the weather forecast was horrible all week. And literally by the time I got to the subway, it was absolutely pouring. So had I waited even a little bit longer before I left, I would have been soaked. But I then went up to Milwaukee the following day to see the Brewers home opener, which was, of course, Milwaukee has a roof. And so even though it was 32 degrees and freezing rain, it was wonderful inside the stadium. So I stayed as long as I could. I was supposed to see the White Sox and the Braves play again on Wednesday, but that game got rained out while I was at the stadium eating lunch. They said, nope, get out. And because I was such a weather wimp, I chose not to go to the Cubs game that evening, which ended up being a crazy game that the Cubs won, I think, 9-8. But we're recording this the afternoon of April 5th, and in just a couple of short hours, I will be walking to Truist Park to see the home opener for the Braves, where Spencer Strider will take the mound and hopefully strike out a lot of Diamondbacks.
Yeah, it's funny that I think like a lot of the I'm not sure off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure like a lot of the East Coast games this week, it has been nothing but rain up here all week. So I'm sure, I don't know how many games they've played in like Baltimore, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and New York and Boston, because it seems like it's rained every single day this week. So yeah, I don't even know.
They've had a couple of postponements and a couple of delays where they would make it up with the doubleheader the next day. And I know, of course, come Monday, the Yankees game was supposed to be in the daytime, but it's being moved to the evening because of the eclipse. So not only rain, but also earthquakes and eclipses and all of nature's ways of showing us who's boss seems to be affecting the weather in the Northeast for the last week or so.
Well, the thing that I found funny is it seemed like social media was, I'm sure much to your delight, social media was full of people panicking about the Mets' winless start. And I was talking to one of the guys at work who's a Yankees fan, and I said, I mean, I realize you don't want to you don't want to be winless, but I'm like, doesn't this seem like a lot of panic for the first week in the season? And then, of course, they won last night. But it just seems, if you want to talk to me, you want to put your statistics hat on, it seems like, while yes, a good week, a good opening to your season can like be a good barometer, I don't know that, you know, starting the season 0-4 and 0-5 is like some sort of death sentence.
Yeah, and you know, if you think about it, the odds of losing four games in a row, assuming it's a 50-50 shot, which it isn't always the case, but Mark, what is the probability of a team losing four games in a row? It's like 50% times 50% times 50% times 50%.
Yeah.
So 1 in 16 chance, which means on average, if there's 30 baseball teams, probably two of them are going to go 0-4, and an average of two of them will go 0-4 to start the season. I'd say there's a strong chance that every team will lose four games in a row over the course of any one regular season, and they'll all probably win four in a row over the course of regular season. So it's just panicking over, especially at the beginning, because people are going to assume if it starts bad, it's not going to get much better. But then there are some people who say, well, there's nowhere for them to go but up. But of course, it's the Mets, so we all know how it's going to end at some point.
And it's also funny that again, this is 1 week into the season, but as we speak, your Braves are the only team in the division above 500. And in the National League Central, everyone is 500 or above.
Yeah, that's also a function of, especially now that every team plays every other team, you don't have as many division games at the beginning of the season. Because it used to be you would always start out against, you know, one of your division rivals. That's a big thing to open the season and also to end the season. And so if that's the case, if every team is playing someone else in their division, you're going to have a lot more parity. You're going to have a lot more teams clustered around that 500 mark. But now the Yankees opened with a West Coast swing. The Braves were, you know, in the Midwest playing non-division teams. It sometimes just happens that some teams will start out hot and some teams won't. I think the Pirates are still undefeated. The Brewers were. I think the Brewers lost yesterday. I think they lost their first game. So, but, you know, again, six games out of 162, we still got a long way to go, and I'm going to see as many of them as I can.
I can tell you that there are currently no undefeated teams left.
Okay.
In Major League Baseball.
There you go. After it took a week.
And there's only one team that's winless, and that's the Marlins.
And the odds of them continuing that going the whole season winless are pretty much nil.
I was going to say, being 0-8 is not great in baseball. Now, if we're talking about football and you're 0-8, that may be a different kettle of fish, as it were, for the Marlins.
Yeah, but the odds of losing 162 games in a row is one half to the 162nd power. So it's a very, very, very tiny number.
Well, I told somebody at work yesterday, you know, again, because of where I am, that, you know, when we were talking about the Mets and they were 0-5 or whatever, I said, having lived through the 1988 Orioles start, when they were 0-21 or 0-22. You know, call me next week when they still haven't won, and then we can discuss matters. But I mean, there may have been, like, I don't remember how bad the Tigers were that year that they were really, really bad, the year that they came close to the Mets record. But,
right.
You know, like, I don't remember. They very well could have started well that year. I don't think they did, but it's entirely possible. But I always say, yeah, it's better to be the 84 Tigers and start 35-5, you know, than the converse.
Right. Although lately it's more about how you do in the playoffs, especially last season for the Braves. They, you know, were literally record setting during the regular season and then one series and they're out. So it's just a matter of timing. That's what happened to the 21 Braves that won the World Series. They got hot at the right time. Just like we were talking about with wrestlers, sometimes it's just being in the right place at the right time. Sometimes it's just about having all your players healthy or clicking or just whatever all at the right time. It's every at bat is an independent event. You've got a 27% chance of getting a hit on average, 26-27%. Winning a game involves several people in a row doing something that only has a 1-in-4 chance of happening. So it's just a series of random events, and the best teams have players that instead of 27% are more like 30% likely to hit, and those tiny differences in the percentages add up, or also because they just have a constructed lineup that's healthy and that complements each other well, and if one guy is slumping, another guy is picking up his slack and streaking.
Well, yeah, you're talking about like just being cold in the playoffs. I mean, the year that the Mariners, I don't know if it's still the regular season record for wins, like Ichiro's first year when he was MVP and technically rookie of the year. I don't remember which round they lost in, but they did not win the World Series.
Yeah, and that's good. That's going to be their legacy.
So, yeah, and like, we were talking about batting averages. Like, I saw again, like my favorite player of all time, Ichiro is like second, but like my favorite player of all time is Tony Gwynn. And I saw people love tweeting out these very crazy batting statistics for Tony Gwynn.
Yeah.
That said something like, this is close, that Tony Gwynn could have gone 0 for his last, like, 1,900 at-bats and still would have finished his career as a 300 hitter.
Or something like he had less strikeouts in his career than Schwarber had last season or something like that.
Yeah, it's one of the – yeah. Yeah, because I remember, I think Mickey Mantle had one of those where, like, yeah, Mickey Mantle has, like, less strikeouts looking than, like, Aaron Judge or something did. Or whoever it was a couple years ago that, like, set the record for strike. You know, one of those
right. Big
slugger guys. But, yeah, but again, that's, that's the joy of baseball is in the numbers sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what always fascinated me about baseball, and I guess that's probably why I ended up doing what I'm doing with Charting the Territories to tie all this up into a nice little bow. See what I did there?
Right, and which leads us nicely into your plugs.
Hey, plugs time. All right. Well, first and foremost, you can catch me on the website application formerly known as Twitter and now apparently known as X, at Al Getz Wrestling. That's Al GETZ Wrestling. And of course, we spent a good amount of time today talking about my latest book, my fourth book. I say books, I call them almanacs, and they're probably more like reference guides. There's very little in the way of behind the scenes dirt like so many wrestling books are. And we've mentioned that there are a lot of results and lineups for cards, but it's much more than that. It's just a very unique data-driven look at wrestling in the territorial era. All four books are available worldwide on Amazon. The best way to find them is to just search for Charting the Territories, Al Getz. You can also get autographed copies of my books from my website at chartingtheterritories.com. We also have a monthly podcast that I host along with John Boucher. It's also called Charting the Territories. And again, the best way to find that on whichever podcasting platform you use is to search for Charting the Territories Al Getz. But each new episodes come out on the second Thursday of every month.
What is the area for the show that's coming out next week?
We are covering the World Wrestling Association based in Indianapolis for 1971. And this would be the year that Dick the Bruiser and Wilbur Snyder decide to challenge the Sheik, Ed Farhat, for supremacy in the Motor City.
It's funny. I got to Indiana just after either they had closed or were in the dying days, because I like had no idea that like that even existed when I went to, like in 1988 when I went to college. So it was like, and you may be able to confirm or deny this, but it seems like Bloomington was never really someplace they ran very often, either probably in the 70s or later in the, like, I think I even asked Cornette about this. I said, like, why did they never run Bloomington very often? And he's just like, it just, I guess, other than it didn't draw, it just, it never was one of their regular stops.
Yeah, Dick, their house show schedule is lighter than any other territory that we've covered to date on the podcast. We have records in 1971 for 85 house shows. So that's, you know, barely one and a half a week. They didn't run a whole lot more than that. We talked about searching through newspapers. I've not only searched through newspapers online, but I've actually been up to Indiana to visit the state archives there. I've been through newspapers for every city and every market that could have had regular wrestling, and they just didn't run that many shows. Dick and Wilbur were getting regularly booked in other places a lot. A lot of their guys would get booked at times for in St. Louis, for the Sheik, for Toronto, for Heart of America, for Vern, other places. And Indianapolis was doing really well, and Chicago was doing really well. So they just didn't need to run as many shows as other territories. But of course, the problem with that is that meant they didn't draw talent. And after some point, the talent pool got stale, because Bruiser and Wilbur and Moose Cholak, you know, were on top for so many years. Eventually, fans were going to tire of them. So that territory is an interesting case study, because they just did not run 6 to 7 nights a week like virtually every other territory did.
Cool. I was thinking about this when I was planning for stuff. How many territories do you have left from 1971 that you have not done yet?
We're going to continue doing this through the end of this year. We started it at the beginning of last year. So by the end of this year, we'll have done 24, and there are probably 5 or so others that were in existence in some fashion in 1971. Now, of course, there are, I'm counting Pittsburgh as a separate entity from not only the WWWF, but also the NWF, because around this time it sort of switches allegiances. I'm also doing East Tennessee separately from Gulas, but I'm combining Knoxville with the other East Tennessee towns, which are 2 separate entities altogether. You know, the short answer, in the U.S. and Canada, there's about 30.
Yeah, I was, because I know, like, when you do the tease at the end of the podcast for what's coming up next, I know, the last couple ones, I've been, like, sort of doing the mental geography in my head going, okay, what's left? I'm like, okay, this place and this place, I think, and I think here, you know, so I'm like, there can't be that many left for you guys to do on the show.
There is, and that's why I like keeping the schedule secret, because you know you think, oh my god, he must have done all of them, and then you realize, oh my god, I forgot, you know, the WWF, for example, which we will get to that later this year. But there are a few other high profile ones, and for the rest of this year, I'm sort of staggering them out between big ones and smaller ones. I'm sort of alternating by design, but also there is a method to the madness, and a lot of times I'll pick a territory to do after another one because there's concepts that carry through. In particular, we've sort of talked about how some territories, there are local promoters that seem to have a lot more say And this was the case in Georgia with Fred Ward's Towns in South Georgia. And then from there, we segued into West Texas, where the lawman Don Slatton and Gory Guerrero were local promoters, but they had a lot more leeway as to what to do in their town that didn't always follow with what was going on in the rest of the territory. So a lot of times I'm doing things in a certain order because I want to acknowledge certain concepts that were done in one territory that are followed through in another.
Cool. And I don't know if you want to mention it, but you have an accolade coming your way in a few months.
I do. This summer, I am going to be receiving a very prestigious award. It is the Jim Melby Award. It's being presented by the Tragos and Fez Hall of Fame in Waterloo, Iowa. I believe I'm the 20th or 21st recipient of this. And reading the names of previous award winners is a veritable who's who of the wrestling historian field. I'm absolutely incredibly honored, and when I found out I was getting it, I was speechless, which anyone who's seen me as a wrestling manager knows is very rare. But yes, I will be in Waterloo in July. Of course, now you've got me on the fence. I got to Google it to get the exact dates. But it is in July in Waterloo, Iowa, going into the Tragos Thez Hall of Fame, along with, I think, Shivani and Arn Anderson are being admitted to the Hall of Fame. It's the weekend of July 18th through the 20th.
Cool. Yeah, we were thinking about, I'm still trying to figure out where I'm going this summer, if I go somewhere. But, mm-hmm. but it's because I thought about going last year and it didn't work out due to funding issues, but like we're talking about maybe going out there or maybe doing the T-Mart show in Charlotte, which is like right around the same time. Like I think they're like within a couple weeks of each other. So
I think T-Mart is early August.
Right. So like it's probably not realistic to do both. So we're trying to figure out, but like I'm trying to, it may be like sort of a podcast guest scouting trip.
Right. That's a good idea. There's also, yeah. And then later in August, the following month, there's the Cauliflower Alley Club in Vegas. So again, these are all stacked up really close together. It's hard if you're only able to do one, it's hard to know which one to do.
Right. And given that I really have, I know you're like a frequent traveler, but, I've gotten to the point in my old age where, like, if I don't have to get on an airplane again, I'm not going to.
Understood.
So Vegas, odds are slim of going to Vegas, whereas Charlotte, you know, not horrible. Iowa, doable. I mean, we used to drive from here out to Indiana when I went to college, so, I mean, it's not something I'm averse to.
It's doable. It's definitely doable. Not easy, but definitely doable.
No, because I know we drove the year that like we did our summer or like my junior summer year where we like did the college tour that we went out to Iowa. So like we did Notre Dame. We did Notre Dame and Bloomington and Iowa and maybe one other. So like all, you know, like in a relatively straight shot back and forth. Mm-hmm. So I remember, I've made that drive before. I don't remember it because it was 25 plus years ago now, whatever it is.
Right. So, yeah.
But I mean, that's a drive I'm not averse to because I wanted to go. I think the lockdown year, we were planning on driving out to Kansas City because I still haven't been to the Negro League Museum yet. So that's definitely like a haul and a half from here. But like that was the year that like I decided no, I'm not going all that far. So like we went out to visit Bo instead. So we went like halfway, you know, and stopped in. I went to Nashville because I hadn't been to Nashville before, and then like went out and saw Bo for a couple of days. So that was that's like about my limit for driving in a day anymore. You know, it's like, how far can I drive in a day? That's about where I'm going to go. But yeah, that the Hall of Fame is definitely something I would love to come out to do, and I would certainly, it would be great if I was there the year that you got inducted.
Yeah, that would be great. You're allowing me to cordially invite you.
I Yeah, like I said, I don't know if like we're going to set like I don't know about the setup process or because they have like a podcast thing at there, or was that just the one? Because they inducted Conrad one year, I think.
Yeah, and well, he was in as the broadcaster award. They're considering podcasting in the same vein as announcing.
Right,
well, but they had what's called a podcaster collective, which was just. People that had wrestling related podcasts were able to get up and talk about their podcast, what it's called, what it covers, and so on and so forth. And there were a lot of podcasters there. So it's a great way for networking too. There might be podcasts you're not familiar with that might cover a subset of wrestling that you're interested in. They also do a live Colt Cabana does a live podcast.
Cool. Yeah. So. It's entirely possible I could see you in the summer. If not, I'll hopefully have you back on at some point. Is there a book coming in the fall? Do you know yet?
The technical answer to your question is no, there is not a book coming in the fall, and that's all I'm going to say.
Okay. Future yes, fall no.
If you want more information, you should listen to the next episode of Charting the Territories coming out the second Thursday of April.
There you go. One final plug before we go. Thanks again, Al. Enjoy the game tonight. Hopefully you don't get rained on.
No, but it's colder than it's supposed to be in Atlanta in April, so I have that to deal with. But definitely not cold, not as cold as it was in Chicago.
Well, that's definitely a good thing. So thanks, Al, again. Everybody check out the pod and the book. And we will talk to everybody next time.
Thanks for having me, Mark. Great to talk to you.
Thanks again.